Mitzvah Resh Ayin Vav 276. Shelo Yavod Kohen Baal Mum Over. We pointed out last time that a Kohen is not allowed to worship at the Beis Hamikdash if he has a bodily blemish, of which there are many times. Certain apply to animals and Kohanim, disqualifying them from the Beis Hamikdash. Different roles in the Beis Hamikdash, obviously, but some disqualify both animals and humans. And some disqualify only humans, meaning Kohanim, and some disqualify only animals. But although we went in a more general discussion last time, the mitzvah, that's technically two separate mitzvahs that govern the blemishes of the Kohanim. The first one is that a Kohen is not allowed to worship if he has a mum kavua, that if he has a set blemish that's not expected to go anywhere. And the other one is that we're going to learn about right now is if he has a blemish that will heal by itself in due course, and he's not allowed to worship while he has that either. We said last time that if somehow he manages to get rid of a mum kavua, something that's not expected to heal itself, so that's also good. He's allowed to start worshiping again once he gets rid of the mum.
That means it really wasn't kavua.
It's called a mum kavua. Certain types of mumin are called a mum kavua, whether or not this person actually happens to be rid of them or not.
Like a strawberry birthmark or something.
What?
Like
the birthmark, I don't think, is a mum at all, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. There's one thing that you can get rid of. It says that if you have an extra finger, a sixth finger, then if you chop it off, then that re-qualifies you, but with the condition that there was no bone. If it's just like a growth of skin that looks like a finger, then if you chop it off, then it's good once you get rid of it. But if it actually had a bone in it like a finger, then even if you chop it off, then that's no good. That's a permanent mum. Okay, fine. So that's just one example. Shelo yavod kohen baal mum over. So that a kohen should not worship when he has a blemish that might disappear. Shenemar kol isha asher bo mum mizera Aaron hakohen lo yigash. That anyone who has a blemish from the seed of Aaron, the priest, will not come forth to worship in the Beis Hamikdash. Kol ribuyahu. Since it says all, it emphasizes all, umar be'afilu mum over. That means even a blemish that is expected to disappear. Ki batchila yazir al mum kavua. First, God says that he's not allowed to worship with a set blemish. Va'yisi savor shehu mutter lavod b'mum over shehu kal mimenu. I would have thought at the first mention of mum, since he's only talking about a mum kavua, you might think, okay, the guy doesn't look so great now, but everybody knows that this blemish is going to go away, so therefore this isn't so severe and he can go worship in the Beis Hamikdash, but this pasuk is telling you that that's not true. Vayisi savor shu mutter lavod b'mum over k'dukal mimenu. I would have thought that you could worship in the Beis Hamikdash with a mum that's going to go away. Lefika chizir gamal ha'over, hu ha'garav v'hayalev, as different types of skin, things, boils, afflictions, or, you know, things like that, that will eventually go away. But nevertheless, you're not allowed to worship in the Beis Hamikdash with them. Mishor sheha mitzvah, kenyan shekasavnu b'mitzvah kodem mitzvah. The same reason that last time we said that the reason that a Kohen's not allowed to have a mum is that people are influenced by things that look good. If people have blemishes that distract people from their appearance, then they're not going to receive the message as well, even if they have something very good and important to communicate. So they're going to be distracted. Like if you have a teacher in a classroom, I'll bring our education discussion now into this year. You have a teacher in the classroom, and the teacher looks very funny. It could be it has some weird feature about the teacher's body. So even if it's the best teacher in the world, and really they have wonderful things to say, the kids are going to be laughing, and they're not going to be paying attention as much because of the physical blemish of the teacher through no fault of his or her own. But nevertheless, that's the reality of the world, that people are affected by visual things. So therefore, the Kohen, people are not going to be as affected by their worship in the Beis Hamikdash if they see that the Kohanim look weird or funny. Okay? Midine ha-mitzvah, the halachos are as follows. Masham ezichan levracha, sha'achad mum kavua, o mum over, posel havoda, whether it's a fixed or unfixed blemish, there's not allowed to worship. Beloke ha-kohen olavim avad b'mezid. And the Kohen will receive the penalty of lashes of malgus if he violates this on purpose. Masham ezichan levracha, she'bezdin ha-godu ha-yu yoshvin b'lishkas ha-gozis, that the high Sanhedrin used to sit in the chamber of hewn stone, famous place where the Sanhedrin used to meet. V'ikar ma'aseyam b'hasmad. Okay, they used to do other things. They used to hear court cases, but one of their main jobs and why they had to be in the base of Mikdash was she'ubodkin ha'kohanim b'yuchsin uv'mumen. That they used to check the gemumen of the kohanim and their yuchsin. So a new kohen would come that we're not familiar with dor after dor, generation after generation, he's a kosher kohen. So he used to check his lineage and make sure that he was really a proper kohen. They used to take edim that they saw his grandfather worship in the on the mizbeach, and they used to accept all these criteria of how to make sure that the person is a real proper kohen or not. And if a kohen had a shaila about whether something that was on his body was a mum or not, so the Sanhedrin used to check and see if it was a mum.
Is an invisible mum, in other words, that is covered up by clothing, considered?
Clothing does not cover mumen, no, but if it's internal, then it doesn't. Then it doesn't count. That's the one of the differences between people and animals. That if an animal has an internal blemish, so it's not allowed to be a korban. But if a person has an internal blemish, then the kohen is still allowed to worship.
So
yeah.
A kohen could be a kidney donor, then, right? You know, without any problem.
A kohen could be a kidney donor, yeah, right. In the situation.
So after, after some scar, but that's not a
right,
scar.
Scar's not a mum, yeah.
So wait a second. So, you know, it sounds like sort of the military, you know. It's, okay, you line up, you know, with inspection, and they go through and regularly, and, you know.
Well, I don't know if they would, like, make the kohen strip and check the kohen before beginning to worship, right. You know,
wait,
go on in the line
joined,
like that.
Yeah, they,
but I think if there was some shaila, they used to look, and they used to make sure about what
and,
was going on.
You know, I mean, in Yenna Dioma, I assume that, you know, kohen has to be biologically male. I mean, you can't have Yentel kohen, you know.
Yes, yes, uh-huh.
Okay, all right.
100%.
Okay, just check.
It has to have all the proper organs in place
and
in order not to be in a, what? Androgynous is not allowed to be a kohen. That's right.
Transgender.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
well, you have to. In other words, you have to have all your. More or less, the general rule is all your body parts have to be in place. So, for a
okay.
male kohen to worship in the base of Mikdash, everything has to check out, so to speak. But we pointed out last time that the one thing where this it's really subjective, where you need to get the Sanhedrin's opinion, is that one of the mumen is being very short or very tall.
Oh, yeah.
So the Chazal never give us an exact shiur about if you're this height, then it's no good, and if you're this height, it's no good. They say, it just said very, you know, unusually short or unusually tall.
It looks like the Marquette's. You know, you don't want somebody sticking up, you know, the chorus line.
You want the legs
the
to be
the chorus
size.
Line, you know, really, okay. You know, it'll stick out,
right.
You know. I mean,
right,
you,
so if somebody, so that's the one thing the Sanhedrin has to decide, whether this person is considered abnormally tall or not. Yeah, or
not
short.
Not to be
whatever.
A wise guy. But,
oh, please,
No, but, okay, all appropriate body parts and stuff, but so suppose the person, okay, in their mind, they're transgender, but they haven't had any surgery, but they're flamingly, just flamingly cross-dressing or whatever. They look
I mean, that might be subject to the Sanhedrin's
judgment call,
but
okay.
What do you mean? All the mumen had nothing to do with clothes.
Yeah.
Okay.
If the kohen shows up, you know, has been just at the beach in Tel Aviv, and then, you know, oh, it's time for me to get to the base of Mikdash. It's my turn to do the, it's my group's
okay.
turn to do the avodah.
Okay.
So he walks into the base of Mikdash in a bathing suit and then puts on his kohanic vestment. Obviously,
okay.
that's not a mum.
Yeah.
Even
okay.
though he's not dressed
okay.
appropriately for, you know, that's not a mum. A mum is only in the body.
So
a kohen is biologically born male. Everything is completely in order. No mumen. So he's allowed to worship, calls
okay.
Manda, he doesn't have any surgeries that transform him. Yeah.
It has nothing to do with visual distraction because of the you said before that.
Well
the Kohanim, when they're in the business, they're all wearing the same clothes.
Yeah.
There's no way of dressing.
No,
it's like the
Rockettes.
You know.
The reason that a Kohen was mom would not be permitted, just like a teacher who has a visible mom, the kids would be laughing and they wouldn't
yeah.
be able to learn. So you're talking about a visible mom, not anything that's covered by clothing.
No.
What? Wait a minute. Everything is no only thing no it, but that doesn't matter. We said like last time there are mumen in body parts that are covered by the Big Day Kahuna. So that an Audi belly button.
Okay. Yeah. Right.
An Audi belly button is a mumen. It's completely covered by clothing in all normal situations, unless you're at the beach. Nobody's gonna know unless the but it's
you can still wear something that's high enough.
Seder, but I'm saying under any normal, even street clothes, nobody's going to know what. Hopefully, nobody's going to know what kind of belly button you have. There are mumen that are totally not recognizable. So it just, in other words, that's part of the rule, that okay. if without clothes, that it's on the body. It has nothing to do with
the
dress.
The point here is that it's not only about distraction.
The distraction is one thing.
This other stuff is a different thing.
That's part of the Tameya Mitzvah, yeah. You know, the Shorshei Mitzvah, the Sefer Chinuch is bringing to help give us a taste for maybe what part of the reasoning of the mitzvah is. Doesn't mean it's the be-all and end-all. Right, yeah.
In terms of a behavior, I mean, what would disqualify a Kohen as being, say, disgrace to the uniform? Okay, I mean, Frieda said it was obviously a behavioral issue, not a...
Things that are that violate normative Kohanic practice and Jewish practice. If it's not necessarily Midoraisa, but we said before that if a Kohen's married to a Grusha, for example, so Midoraisa, he's allowed to worship in the Beis HaMikdash. But the Rabbana, Midorabbana, so he's not allowed to worship in the Beis HaMikdash. Okay. So this is subject to the rabbinical discretion as to whom they want to allow to worship
so
in the Beis HaMikdash or not. So they probably wouldn't be allowed, but it's not an official. That's a subjective thing. That's not a right. That's not
like for a shochet or for a road or whatever. They you know, same kind of standards of behavior, which hopefully would
disgrace to the uniform. That's
right. Okay. Well, it's a military.
Right for a shochet.
Oh, I know.
That's one of the big differences between different hashgachas you have nowadays. You have non-Hasidic hashgachas. You have that for meats especially. So you have that each group only wants to eat the meat that's certified by their group, because they believe that a shochet is not just governed by strict halacha, but they only want to eat from the shechita of a shochet who adheres to the norms of their community. Okay. Right?
It's not the knives anymore. That's
right. The halachic standards, per se, are among all the reliable hashgachos are nowadays are more or less the same.
So, but if a Kohen marries a Grusha, wouldn't the Kohanim invalidate or the Rabbanim invalidate the marriage?
No, the marriage is good.
The marriage is just worshipping in the
It's just that the guy's kids lose their...
Right,
genes.
Right. Well, they have to get divorced by way of a get. Their marriage is contracted. They're actually married, but it's a forbidden marriage, so they have to get divorced by way of a get. If you marry someone who's... a real serious erva the Chayiv Karis. You marry your sisters, you give her a ring, and you say, I read Mikudesh, that's nothing. It doesn't require the solution in any way. It's not the marriage is not contracted. Yeah. Fine.
It doesn't require a get, but marrying
it. Fine. So what happens? The Sanhedrin used to check the Kohanim to make sure that they were appropriate to worship in the Beis HaMikdash. The Chol Kohen Shenimtza Posel BeYuchsin, if they found that he was no good, so Lo VeShchorim UMisatev Shchorim VeYotze Min HaZara. So he used to put on black garments and leave the temple courtyard as a sign of mourning. And nowadays, it's interesting, there's a total difference in societal perception of clothing. Nowadays, we view black clothing generally as fancier than white clothing. But in the olden days, they used to view black clothing as a lower level of dressing up than white clothing.
Black clothing when they were in mourning.
Right, black clothing when they were in mourning, right? But even in Jewish, dress, certainly, that, the Rosh Yeshiva and the Chassidim and people who are dressing have these uniforms on Shabbos and the highest occasions where the highest level of dress is required. They wear long black coats. In the classical halachic literature, this was frowned upon. They said on Shabbos, the Mikubalim, the Kabbalists, felt that you're supposed to wear white on Shabbos, Dafka. So you find people in Israel, interesting... mystical types of
people. Wear white?
They don't wear white exactly. They wear stripes.
Oh, stripes.
Yeah.
The white socks, right?
Right. They're Yotze the white with the socks, right? But we assume that normative halacha, even Rav Svardi, great rabbanim who are generally more into the Kabbalah than the Ashkenazim, they also wear black even on Shabbos, and they write that even though the Mekubalim say you're really supposed to wear white on Shabbos, but somewhat this goes by societal differences, and now that it's mikubal, that it's accepted that black is the more formal, so we wear black on Shabbos. And even in the secular society, so black is more formal. Just think tailcoats or tuxedos, so the main color of those uniforms are black. Yeah.
There's some Litvish yeshiva, in Israel, 6 years ago, where they all wear white.
Litvish yeshiva.
A Litvish yeshiva where everybody was wearing white. I mean, they must have had a dry cleaner on staff or something like that. But But, you know.
Not just white shirts.
Wearing
no,
white?
But, yeah, white.
White
yeah,
suits?
Yeah, I remember that.
Mark
Shearer
yeah,
talked
about
that.
Well, not so odd. It was actually, I think, I can't remember which yeshiva it was. But, yeah.
What, in the summer or just them? To...
It's always summer there, you know. I don't know. All right. I mean, whatever.
They'll make, well, linen suits. Yeah.
I mean, you just see the pictures of, say, the Mir Yeshiva in the old days, and, you know, they're all very nicely and nattily dressed with, you know, bowler hats. And,
but not
know.
With white. I mean,
no,
they,
not white.
They wear whatever color suits they wanted. They didn't have a set mm-hmm. uniform the same
okay.
way they do nowadays. Yeah.
Okay,
so he used to leave the Beis Mikdash, v'chol mi shenimtza shalem, if he's found to be without a mum, v'kosher, and he has good yichus, lovesh levonim, v'nichnas v'mishamesh yimechav hakohanim. Then he puts on white and as a sign of joy, and he goes in. Umisha nimtza kosher, b'yichuso v'nimtza bo mum. Oh, but you have someone who's in between, that his yichus is perfectly fine, but he has a mum. He has a blemish that disqualifies him from himself from worshipping. Has nothing to do with his descendants, nothing to do with, you know, after he's healed, he'll be perfectly fine, if he can be healed. Yoshe belishka so eitzim, maslia eitzim lamaracha. So what does he get, what's his wonderful, happy job? He's got to extract the bugs from the wood that's going to go on the Mizbeach.
Oh.
So he has to make sure that all the bugs, like, he didn't have bugs on the Mizbeach. So I asked.
Oh, Bodek firewood? I mean, you know, really?
What?
You mean you can't have bugs inside the wood? That seems like.
That's part of the job, yeah. He has to get, yes, you put it over a, you know, a heat source, I guess, and make the bugs all leave, and then you have a bug free.
Okay.
Of course, nowadays we don't need this because there'll be Positive and Bodek and all these different types of brands of logs that, you know, when the Beis Hamikdash is rebuilt, we'll have pre, you know, in a vacuum pack, we'll have logs that are grown in a greenhouse with an environment that is completely free of bugs.
Okay. New York
site.
You can't wash the New York
State
tap water.
Exactly. Yeah. V'cholek b'kodshim im anshei beis av shelo v'ochel. So he's allowed to eat. In other words, there are certain korbanos that are eaten by the kohanim who are on duty at that time. Not the kohen who actually physically offered the korban, but that they're shared by all the kohanim that are on duty during this this week. So he can partake of those. There's no problem with someone who has a mum from eating kodshim. He's only not allowed to worship, perform the worship in the Beis Hamikdash. Shenemar lechem elokav mikodshim kodashim in a kodshim yochel. He's allowed to eat it. Fine. It says beferish in the pasuk. B'yeser kol dini hamumim b'vchoros perik shvi. The rest of the dinim are in the seventh parak of Maseches Bechoros. Why do these halachos find themselves in Maseches Bechoros? Because Bechor is talking about the firstborn animals and their halachic status, so it goes through the mumen that would prevent an animal from being considered a full Bechor, would lose its kedusha, and you'd be allowed to eat it normally. So then it says, oh, by the way, now that we're already talking about mumen, so we're going to tell you what are the mumen of Kohen, a person as well, yeah? Benoegas b'zman abayis b'kohanim, in the times of the Beis Hamikdash with Kohanim, avar ve'avad b'mum over b'mezid loke. Fine, if you do it on purpose, you see the penalty of lashes. V'ramban zichar no levracha has a different sheet. Lo yimne ze alav shel mum over lo lav bifnei atzmo. He doesn't count the mum over as a separate lav. V'chasav v'chalal lav de mum kavuahu. It's just one, it's just part of the prohibition of a mum kavua. Hu kemo chilek mechelke mitzvah. Just one mitzvah that you're not allowed to worship with a blemish. And sometimes there are fixed blemishes and sometimes there are transient blemishes. He even agrees with the Rambam in principle. He and the Rambam both agree that if there's just one mitzvah with two different parts, you don't count them as separate mitzvahs. You count them as one mitzvah. Just that here the Rambam feels it's not two parts of a mitzvah. Two separate mitzvahs. One is a mum kavo, one is mum over. And they're two separate mitzvahs. But the Rambam says, no, that's not true. They're really it's really just one mitzvah with two components. Obviously, you can't not each. It's not that each part of a mitzvah is always counted as a separate mitzvah, and you have tons and tons. You have way more than 613.
So, what is the consequence of either position? Whether you count it as one or two, what difference?
Not much. And you think that the Ramban was correct, that was just one mitzvah about a blemish, but
just throws off something else.
Right, the Ramban has a whole... The Ramban has, in the back of his commentary, at the end of his commentary on the Rambam Sefer Mitzvos, he says, well, I deleted all these mitzvos from the Rambam's count, so how am I going to make it up? And he has his own...
he actually writes that.
Yeah. So he tells you what he counts as a mitzvah, the Rambam doesn't count as a mitzvah.
An accounting problem, you know, you're short. And,
right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Mitzvah Reish Ayin Zayin, 277, that somebody who has a blemish should not enter the sanctuary of the Beis HaMikdash. Shelo Yikonis Baal Mum BaHeichal Bichlalo, you shouldn't go into the Beis HaMikdash at all. Kilomer La Mizbech, Uvein Ulam La Mizbech, Uvechol Shar Makom Lo SheBaHeichal, you shouldn't go in to the inner part of the Beis HaMikdash at all, if you have a mum.
So this applies to any, not just Kohanim?
Only Kohanim are allowed to go in there in the first place. So no non-Kohanim allowed to go in there at all. So it's talking only about Kohanim and ones that have a mum.
Yeah,
Shenemar. Achel haparuches lo yavo. These are wonderful. Achel haparuches lo yavo ve'al mizbech lo yigash. That he shouldn't come into the place where the curtain is, and he shouldn't come to the mizbech. Okay, ben izbar b'sifrosh shnei lavin elesh al paruches mizbech lo yaspik echad me'am bilti chaviro. Then that shouldn't count as two separate mitzvos. Because they complement each other. It just means that you shouldn't go here and you shouldn't even go here. It's not two separate mitzvahs. And I think if you have, look at the art school, Sefer Chinuch, they have a beautiful diagram of the different places where exactly the border is that you're not allowed to go. It's fine. Pass the mizbeach towards the heichal. Mishoshia mitzvah lahagdil kvod habayis v'hadara. It's to enhance the glory of the Beis HaMikdash. Alkein ein roi lavo sham baal mum kiu makom hashleimus. A person who has a blemish shouldn't even go there because it's a place of absolute
perfection.
Good. Eino bedin lamod sham mishiyesh bo shum chisar. You shouldn't even stand there, somebody who has any blemish whatsoever. The main theme of the Sefer HaChinuch's explications of how we treat the Beis HaMikdash is that we have to treat it in a way that inspires awe at all times. We shouldn't let it get in our anything, chip away at our perfect vision of the Beis HaMikdash. They're the same thing. Anything that's considered to be on a lower level shouldn't go in at all. At least vis-a-vis Kohanic worship. Dinei HaMitzvah Yisrael, he's allowed to bring a korban with an outie belly button, you know what I mean? It's not, but Kohanim are supposed to exemplify the Beis HaMikdash, shouldn't go into this place, which is the holiest of places, with any mum. Dini HaMitzvah, Kolomer Mahein HaMumen, Shebishvilen Yimane HaKohen Milkane, Zachartim Lamalas, Somuch Bremez Vazhares, Balmum Kavua, Vesham Hodati Mekoman, Begemar, Vechol Inyan, Hainyan Kemihag. I explained what the mumen are before, and the same mumen that the Kohen is not allowed to go into the Beis HaMikdash. The Chosav HaRamban, Zichrono Levracha, the Ramban again does not like what the Rambam has to say about this mitzvah. Shein Lanu Lakshov Zala Veminyan Halavin, Shisri Kanes, Balmum Bahechal, this doesn't count as a mitzvah at all. Begam Pirue Rosh, Rukwe Begotim, Veshosui, Enu Ela Maila, Midivreyam, Zichrono Levracha. Below ba hakasuv azeh el leslor makom kreva lavoda mehem kreva lavoda v'zebichalav devalmum shelo yavodhu. He says, Rambam, you completely misunderstood. It's the same mistake you made before when you said that somebody who's drunk is not allowed to go into the Beis HaMikdash. The Torah says beferish that somebody who's drunk is not allowed to perform the worship in the Beis HaMikdash. When it says that you shouldn't go into the Beis HaMikdash either, the Torah just means, it's just, you know, strengthening this idea that he's not allowed to do the worship. The Torah doesn't mean literally that there's a separate Isser for somebody who's drunk to enter the Beis HaMikdash, which the Rambam says there. So here as well, when the Torah says that somebody with a mum, it says, Achel HaParuches Lo Yavo V'Al Mizbech Lo Yigash, it doesn't mean that there's a separate prohibition for him to go in. It just means they shouldn't come into the Mizbeach and start doing the Avoda. It's just strengthening. It's just an additional explanation and description of the mitzvah that he's not allowed to do the worship. So he says this is not true at all. This is not a separate mitzvah that someone with a mum is not allowed to go into the Beis HaMikdash at all. It's only an Isser Derabanan. The Rabbanan said, so since it's part of the glory of the Beis HaMikdash, part of the spirit of the laws of what a Kohen is allowed to do and not allowed to do. So somebody, a Kohen who's not allowed to do the Avodah, is not even allowed to go into the Beis HaMikdash if he's drunk. If he has his hair is too long, if he has a mum, he's not allowed to go into the certain parts of the base, at least for this one, certain parts of the Beis HaMikdash at all. He says it's just not true. The Chasavod Sha'af Heim Lo Asrael Amokam Manikra Bein Ulam V'la Mizbech Shukav Beizama Aval Kenegin HaMizbech Atzul Shulam Beizama Lo Asrael. It's only past the Mizbech. I explained the Ramban's sheet about these matters above in Parshas Shmini. Okay. Mitzvah Reish Ayin Ches. Mitzvah 278. Yavod Kohen Tomei. So not only a Baal Mum, but a Kohen who is Tomei, who's ritually impure, is not allowed to worship in the Beis HaMikdash. Shelo yavo yavo kohen ba'odo tamei shenamar v'inazru mikotshei b'nei Yisrael v'lo yechalu Hashem kotshi v'amr zichron al-lebracha. Beperek chi misanedron, they shouldn't desecrate the name of God by worshipping, they should separate themselves from the kotshim, the sacrifices of the children of Israel, not desecrate my name by worshipping when they're tamei. V'amr zichron al-lebracha, beperek chi misanedron, minayin l'tamei sheshimei shu b'misa, if the kohen worships when he's tamei, so he is chai of misa b'dei shamayim, divine death. It says in a different pasuk, and they shall die if they desecrate it. So therefore, since it says over here desecrate, it says over there die if they desecrate. So you see that a Kohen is going to die if he worships the in the state of Tumah. Yeah.
Okay. I tried, by the way, looking ahead in the Art School English to see if he answers the question, you know, later on. So, but
okay.
I don't quite understand it. Obviously, there is a specific pasuk for the Kohanim.
Yeah.
Regarding, you know, being tahar in the Beis HaMikdash, but nobody who's Tomei can go to the Beis HaMikdash.
Right, but it's Chayim Misa. This is what engenders the Misa B'nei Shamayim.
Uh-huh.
And also saying that if he does the worship when he's Tomei, so the worship is no good.
He's also Chayav Misa, though, isn't he? Or no?
Not Bidei Adam, not Bidei Shemayim.
Okay.
Ah.
Oh, strange. You'd think it would be worse. Well, I guess maybe. I mean, okay.
But it's just an additional level that relates to the Kohanim. Mishor Shea Mitzvah, Machiko Sabnu, and Makomos Rabim. So since the person is on a higher spiritual level when tahor, so therefore all the worship has to be done by the Kohanim when they're tahor, and in order for the honor of the Beis HaMikdash, so no one who's tamei, who's on a lower spiritual level, is allowed to do the worship. Okay, it's part of the idea that we're supposed to view the Beis HaMikdash in the highest of terms. Dine ha-mitzvah, what are the halachos? Kiyon marhein ha-tumos ha-metamos midaraisa, metamos midarabanan, what's tamei midaraisa, what's tamei midarabanan? Uveizen yin yitar ha-tamei mitumaso, how do you get tahor? Veizu tuma tzricha hazo, v'korban letaroso, v'eno tzricha el tvila v'harav shemesh. So certain types of tuma, meaning, well, for Mitzora, you need the waiting period, but for tumas mace, if you come into contact with a dead body, so you need to be sprinkled with the ashes of the Parah Aduma on day 3 and 7, and then you come, and then you go to the mikvah, and then you're tahor. Sometimes, if it's a different type of tumah, so then you simply go to the mikvah, then you wait till nighttime, and then you're completely tahor. And that's when the Kohen's allowed to start worshipping. Umiklah ha'inyen, shi'ev shalolam, lalos, bishum tumah, kiyem betvila, be'ezu tumah, tzricha shiva, yamim letarasa. But you never, ever, there's no such thing as becoming purified without immersion in a mikvah. Yeah. Be'ezo yaspik la yomechad. Fine, most tumas only you have to be tummy for one day or part of one day even. Be'ezo rube prate nyonim eila sherabul rabul imala yizbaru kulam beseder taros. So all these things are explained in the Seder Taros of the Mishnah, Tosefta, Gemara, etc. But Regis beKohanim bezman habayis, it applies to the Kohanim in the times of the Beis HaMikdash. The Kohen over alav v'avad b'tumah chaya misa b'dei shamayim. Right, there's no temporal punishment. It's simply misa b'dei shamayim. Okay. Mitzvah reishayin tes, mitzvah 279. Shelo yochal Kohen tomei truma. That a Kohen who's in a state of tuma should not eat truma. We haven't really explained yet in the Sefer Chinuch what truma is. We'll discuss that. There'll be in a future mitzvah. Mm-hmm. Mitzvah to separate truma, but truma is the portion of the food that is given to the Kohanim and has Kedusha in it. In other words, there's Truma and there's Meiser. So the certain types of things that you have to separate from your produce do not have Kedusha. Even if you have to give them to the Levi, for example, or you have to go eat them in Yerushalayim yourself, they don't have Kedusha per se. So if the Levi, if you give the Levi, your neighbor is a Levi, and you come over with some bushels of produce and you say, hey, Mr. Levi, I have your Meiser for you, here you go. You give him the Levi, the Levi says, oh, thank you very much. And he says, by the way, would you like to join us for a dinner tonight? Well, I'm cooking all these produce into a stew, so the Yisrael can say, is the neighbor, and say, yes, Mr. Levi, I'd love to join you and eat your Meiser. There's no Kedusha to the Meiser. The Levi is allowed to do with it whatever he wants. But the Truma, which comes in several forms. There's the Truma Gedola, which is the Truma that's given by the that's part of the original gifts that you have to give out of your produce. There's also Trumas Meiser, which is that the Levi, once he receives the Meiser, the tenth, has to give a tenth of that to the Kohen as a Truma. Also, then there's also Bikurim, and there's also Challah, which we discussed on Shabbos, that Challah is an example of truma that can only, all these things that are called truma can only be eaten by the Kohanim and with purity, and they have a holiness to them. So if the Kohen, if you give your truma to the Kohen, and then the Kohen says, wow, this truma looks amazing, you know, maybe his truma is, you know, you're a winemaker, and you're making your super reserve edition of your wine, and you normally sell the bottle for $200 to the general public, but you have no choice. You have to give some of it to the Kohen for free because you have to give him the truma. Okay, this Kohen who received the truma, he says, "Oh, this is such a good wine. You know, I want to share it with my friend who's Yisrael or a Levi." So that's no good. It can only be eaten by the Kohanim and members of their household. Fine. Shelo yochal kohen tome truma shenemar. What does it say? Ish ish mizer aron bakodshim lo yochal ad asher yitar. So he's not allowed to eat the holy stuff until he becomes pure. Amrina b'maseches mako says harla truma minayin. Where is there a pasuk in the Torah that says you're not allowed to eat truma in a state of tuma? Kolomar shelo yochal en tome shenemar ish ish. It says each person from the descendants of Aaron. So what does that mean? What's something that's possible to be eaten by any descendant of Aaron, either male or female? It must be talking about truma, because if we're talking about sacrifices, so certain sacrifices are only allowed to be eaten by male kohanim at that time. So it must be, this pasuk must be talking about truma, which is the source for the explicit command that a Kohen or any is not allowed to eat truma in a state of tuma. They shall keep my watch. So the same thing is that they have to keep the mishmeres, the watch of God, meaning that they're not allowed to eat the food that's divinely ordained to them in a state of tuma. The Sefer Chinuch does not discuss here, by the way, as the Minchas Chinuch points out, what happens if a Kohen who's tahor eats truma that's tamei. Here we're only, this mitzvah, by the way, is only talking really about if the Kohen is tamei, not if the food is tamei. So the Minchas Chinuch brings that this is a mitzvah's asei. It's not part of the mitzvah's los asei. It says that you should go to the mikvah ve'achar yochal min hakodoshim. Afterwards, you eat the holy stuff. So, meaning that you're not supposed to impurify yourself. I mean, not supposed to impurify yourself with tamei food. That you're supposed to be tahor and then eat the food. Well, Chazal derived from this that there's a mitzvah say that the kohen is only allowed to eat truma when the truma is tahor, yeah?
Now, Kohanim and Leviim, obviously, they're not allowed to own land. They can't work, you know, though. But is there anything to prevent them from, say, renting out a field and being farmers themselves? And if so,
time constraints.
Okay. Oh, I see. So just like, you know, like...
Their
like,
job
like,
is.
Sure, okay. So just like a Talmud Chacham, you know, not having time for a job, in other words, that sort of thing, right? Yeah, okay. But no, seriously, though, if a Levi does, or a Kohen does, in fact, grow crops...
I mean, they had crops. There were cities of the Levium, and they had, you know, that, you know, they weren't part of the regular Nachala, but they were cities of the Levium, and they had stuff around, they had fields surrounding the city.
So what was the status then of their crops?
You have to separate. Yeah. You always have to separate the Matanos.
Even if, in fact,
if the Kohen just says, right, 100%. Even if the Kohen just says, takes a poor portion of the produce and says, Harezo Trumach, you know, and munches it himself, that's fine, but it has to be separated.
Okay.
You're never allowed to eat tevel, which is produce from which the gifts have not been separated at all. Yeah, has to be definitely separated. So again, it's less severe, the eating the truma when it's tame, less severe than the Kohen himself being tame, but that is in fact also usur. Fine. So what do you do with truma that's tame? You can get what's called hanoas kilui. You can either burn it and enjoy the warmth. You can use it. But there are ways that the Kohen can use it without actually eating it. Okay. Mishor she hamitzvah why lahagdil yaker b'leiv kol adam kol asher bakodesh. The people should have a high regard and resulting behavior from things that are holy. So if somebody purifies himself and has the proper spiritual state, so the eating of the truma is going to be taken on a higher level, and thus we'll have a higher regard for the Kohanic status and the presence that God ordains that the person give to the Kohen. Midini ha-mitzvah. What are the lachos? Again, it's misa bidei shemayim velokel, and you receive the penalty of lashes. Aval ochal truma tamea afal pishu belav eino loke levish eino kodesh. So if we're talking about now the Kohen is tame and the food is tame, not if the Kohen is Torah and the food is tame. So if he's tame and he ate truma that's tame, if they're both tame, then you don't receive the penalty of lashes because you're not desecrating the truma in the same way. If the truma is tahor and supposed to be eaten by a tahor kohen, and your kohen eats in a state of tumah, so he's desecrating the truma. But if the truma is tame also, and I'm tame, I'm the kohen's tame, and then he's eating it, so then he's not really desecrating the truma, even though it's usur. It's still usur, but it's not in the same level of prohibition. So this is, if you remember your Gemara, this is the first daf in Brachas. Remember your, so when you first start Shas. What? It says the beginning of the first line in the literature of Chazal. What is the time that you're allowed to start saying the Shema at nighttime, from the time that the Kohanim enter to eat their Truma? So the Gemara talks about this and says, you know, Mishnah, why didn't you just tell us the time? Like, why'd you give us this roundabout way?
They didn't have watches anyway. They couldn't tell that exactly what time it was.
Because it's not based on a time. It's based on astronomical phenomenon. So it says that the reason that it's put in this way is because it wants to teach you extra halachas. It wants to teach you that just like the first time for reading Kriya Shema at night is Tzeisa Kochavim, the appearance of three stars, so too the time for that the Kohanim are allowed to eat their truma after having gone to the mikvah during the daytime is when three stars appears, because that's called Harev Shemesh. That's the end of the halachic day. It's a disappearance of the main light of the day, and it's now halachic nighttime, and the tevila has its full effect, and the Kohanim are now allowed to eat it, yeah?
There's a small digression here, which is that, in fact, in the history of clockmaking, turns out there's a Professor David Landes of Shalom, you know, in fact, wrote a book about this, it's very thing. And of course, since he's a monomer, of great interest to you, I know, so it might be. It turns out that, in fact, that they, both Jews and Muslims, both, although they had certain times they had to do things, or did not, these were all sort of vague astronomical phenomena, or whatever it was, that they did not need any specific time. The ones who really, really needed them were, in fact, really the Christians, the monks. Because they had their prayers, vespers, and so on and so forth. You know, really, really, they had to be absolutely on time. And that's one of the...
They weren't connected to astronomical phenomena, even in the Middle Ages?
Apparently, it was such a point where it was important for them in fact, to know exactly when to start. It was something, you know, and so that was one of the explained that I suppose you know what you're talking about. In fact, this is one of the things which drove, you know, early medieval clockmaking. And, you know, and then, of course, you had navigation and so forth, which we all required of, really.
Mm-hmm.
But he said the Jews and the Muslims, you know, hey, you know, you look up there, okay, I guess it's time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. In the times of Chazal, they had no clocks, right? And they had just sundials, which is why our halachic times are in what we call shos manios. Even during the daytime, it's in relative hours. It goes by the length of the day as opposed to a set hour of 60 minutes. Because in a sundial, you know, the sun casts a shadow based on its path across the sky, so you know what percentage of the sun's path has been completed for the day, and that's how we calculate times in halacha. Doesn't matter that hours are a different length in the winter and the summer. That's just how life worked. There was no such thing as exact clocks in the times of Chazal, which is a big. There is some discussion in the Achronim that some of the Achronim wanted to say that no, halachic this concept of shos manios is not correct. Really, it's talking about in halacha even fixed hours. But that's obviously been completely rejected even within the halakhic literature. But in addition to that, we have the evidence. We know that in the times of Chazal, there simply were no clocks. They just didn't. That's how everyone told time was by a sundial. It's also a big kasha, by the way, on the so-called shita of the Magen Avraham, which is the shita of many Rishonim as well, which is that the shos manios are calculated from dawn until Tzeisa Kochavim, instead of from sunrise to sunset, which is very difficult because, again, you're assuming that the way they told time was with a sundial. It wasn't based on these fancy calculations that you have on maizmanim.com. I didn't have the tools to do such a thing, so it was simply a sundial. So the sundial works from sunrise to sunset. It doesn't work from dawn till dusk, because before sunrise, there's no sundial, there's no shadow, there's no nothing. It just doesn't work.
Why did Hasidim adopt the Magen Avraham's position regarding, you know, late Mincha and so forth, very late Mincha sometimes? Is there any just, you know, like a...
Well, that's not the Magen Avraham's man per se. Uh-huh. The Magen Avraham did hold like Rabbeinu Tam, but the exact...
Rabbeinu Tam, wrong.
No, it's connected to Rabbeinu Tam. That the Rishonim hold like Rabbeinu Tam are generally the ones that hold that the shos manios go from dawn till dusk rather than sunrise to sunset. But it's also based on the idea that davening mincha late is based... Again, Rabbeinu Tam, in my opinion, does not mean that Tzeisa Kochavim is later. It means it's just a different way of understanding the times of the day. Uh-huh. That's what I think. I can't go into it now. It's a whole long, very, very involved discussion. But basically, davening mincha a little late is not the end of the world. There is a legitimate, there's a machlokas rishonim as to whether the last time for mincha is the beginning of Bein HaShemashos, what we colloquially call Shkia, or whether it's Tzeisa Kochavim, the end of Bein HaShemashos. So that's a legitimate machlokas. So nowadays everybody's very makbid to daven mincha until daven mincha before Shkia in the non-Hasidish world. Most people are pretty makbid on that. But the Hasidim, if you daven mincha 10 minutes, 15 minutes maybe after Shkia, it's not the end of the world. But if you daven some Hasidim, based on this, in my opinion, misunderstanding of Rabbeinu Tam, so if you daven mincha an hour after Shkia, so that's in my opinion, is completely wrong. There's nothing to discuss about that.
Mishnagdim,
one of
the big issues they had,
yeah,
was tefillah with the
Chassidim.
Both the,
well, that's
both
even
Shacharis. And the Demonim, right?
They certainly,
they took that very, very seriously. You cannot change from Nusach Ashkenaz to Nusach Sfarad.
Absolutely.
And you can't have to die at the right time. This was like, you know.
Well, that's, now you're talking about Shacharis, even more.
So the Chassidim,
as well known, they feel they need to make their appropriate preparations. They need to go to the mikvah. They need to meditate. They need to learn Kabbalah before davening sometimes to get in the proper mood. So that's why a lot of Hasidim are not makbid to daven at the proper time, even before, you know,
Zahos Matfila. The ones who are makbid, though, will say Shema and Shmon Esrei beforehand before they go to the shul.
Shmon Esrei probably not, because then you get the problem of Smichas Gula Tfila, but I hope they say Shema before they go to shul, at the very least. But it's not really right. If you're up already, if you have no choice, so you daven later, but if you're up, so... I mean, you don't need me to convince you of this, but it's proper to daven Krishma with a brachas and with smichas gula letvila at the proper time.
So wait, so the is there a separate zman for Shemona Esrei, or is it simply supposed to be?
Yeah. No. The zman for it's lechatchila until the fourth halachic hour, and b'dievet until chatzos.
So if you start davening at 10 o'clock on the Shabbos morning, then you're
If you start brachos at 10 o'clock on Shabbos morning, you're probably going to get past Shabbos Mantila, but hopefully you'll be before Chatzos.
Okay.
There are shittas. Yeah, we paskin, we assume the chumra that you're not allowed even to make birka. You're not even if you say you have to say krishma without the brachos if you're davening late before Zman Krishma. We assume that you're only allowed to say birkas krishma until Sov Zman Tfila, the fourth halachic hour. There are rishonim who disagree with that, but nevertheless, davening after Zman Tfila, even as before Chatzos, is very not recommended for this reason, but like I said, it's really if you're up, if there's any way of doing it, so it's really not proper to go to a lay minyan where they say krishma later than the proper time. You're supposed to say krishma with the brachos and with michas gila tefila before zman krishma, not before zman tefila. Okay. So what happens? A harav shemesh. Lucky you. You have a little bit more flexibility with your zmanim for the morning davening. Okay.
Shemesh. Some days you just need to take a lady crew.
Check your privilege.
Oh yes.
Fine. So b'harav shemesh. So the kohanim can eat the truma at the harav shemesh. The Yeroyu Barakia Shlosha Kochavim Beinonios. Three medium-sized stars. What's a medium-sized star?
You can't see them in New York City, whatever it is.
There's a discussion. There's an interesting sefer. I have an electronic copy of it if you want, actually. It's called Yom Valaila Shel Torah. And it has in there... Shel Torah. Shel Torah. So... In it, he has a discussion. He quotes earlier sources, but he has a whole summary of the discussion as to what stars are considered medium. So he thinks that the only stars that are not considered medium are planets. That any actual, what we call in English, stars are considered to be medium-sized stars. So if you see three of those, then it's a halachic nighttime. Okay. I mean, I don't think we can say with definitive... certainty that we know exactly what Chazal had in mind with these three medium-sized stars, which is why, when it comes to Tzeis Kochavim for things that we have Tzeis Kochavim for nowadays, like Zman Krishma, nighttime, like ending Shabbos, so we're more machmir, and we require three small stars, because we're not sure exactly what the medium size stars are, but the stars that appear small, again, if you're not living in a place without light pollution, and you know exactly, more or less, the relative size of stars... So we rely on the small stars for these things, yeah?
They say the Naval Observatory, wherever they go, have the same standards of sunrise and sunset as we have, or is it,
Oh, that's an excellent question, which I will discuss at this in the next sentence. The Zeha Ace, who...
I should have read ahead, sorry.
This time, that's okay. No, that's fine. The Zeha Ace, who kamo shlish sha'a achar shkia sachama. The time for Tzeis HaKochavim, for the three medium-sized stars, is about 20 minutes after sunset. So interesting, the Minchas Chinuch says, where does the Sefer Chinuch get this 20 minutes from? He explains it's based on the sheet of the Rambam, but interestingly, this line actually appears in the Rambam, in the correct Girsa. That in the olden days, they didn't have this Girsa in the Rambam. It doesn't appear in the older printings of the Rambam, but in the manuscripts of the Rambam, he himself gives the figure of 20 minutes after sunset, for seeing three medium-sized stars. Oh, okay. So the question is, Rabosai, can one actually see three medium-sized stars 20 minutes after sunset? Say in Eretz Yisrael. Say in Eretz Yisrael, where the halachic literature is mainly talking about. If there's no light pollution. Yeah, I'm asking. Who's looked?
If I'm there, I'll make sure to look.
The answer is... it's very, very tight. Maybe on some days, under some conditions, if you have a liberal definition about what star is considered medium, then you can see three stars 20 minutes after sunset. But under normal conditions, it takes a little bit longer, 25, 30, something like that, a little bit longer, which raises the possibility that... we call sunset nowadays based on the Naval Observatory, which is when the top of the disk of the sun sinks below the horizon, the top, that's sunset according to astronomical standards nowadays. It raises the possibility that that's not actually called sunset in halacha, shkiyas achama. That when we say shkiyas achama in halacha, we don't mean the ball of the sun going below the horizon, the top of the ball of the sun. We mean that the bright light of the sun disappears. Again, what exactly that means is a little bit hard to tell because we basically lost the Mesorah for what exactly shkiyas achama is in halacha because we are machmir nowadays, the contemporary minag is, that I'm not advocating going against this, chas v'shalom, that we are machmir, that sunset is what we call shkia, is what the astronomical definition of sunset, which is when the top of the ball goes below the horizon. And for Shabbos, we need even a few minutes before that for Tosefes Shabbos. But it raises the question that what the Rishonim and the Geonim meant when they said shkia sachama was in fact a time that was a little bit later. So, but basically, you don't go based on the time. You base that when three stars appear. And again, we are not Bucky in the three medium-sized stars. So we go based on three small stars. And for Motzei Shabbos, we go even more than that. And we require three small stars close together because of Tosefes Shabbos. So that's the Zman that we in our shul use for Tseisa Kochavim on Motzei Shabbos. That we use the time that, according to Rabbanim who have checked for three small stars close together, that's the time. We don't go based on a fixed number of minutes after sunset. We go on an astronomical prediction of when the phenomenon is actually going to be visible. So that's something to keep in mind that, again, so what I object to very strongly is that certain poskim will tell you that okay they don't have they assume sunset is astronomical sunset. That's the again it's a whole long discussion, but they assume sunset astronomical sunset. So no, it says here that sunset is that Tzeis Kochavim is about 20 minutes after sunset. So no, Tzeis Kochavim is 20 minutes after sunset. So we don't see the stars. So we'll have light pollution. We don't know exactly what stars they're talking about. We accept this definition that it's 20 minutes after sunset. Some people have more lenient definitions about the time after sunset. So that's very fallacious because that's assuming that you don't know what the three stars are, but you know exactly what Shkiyas Achama is. This is complete, in my opinion, that's completely incorrect. I had someone who you're not allowed. Certainly, Lakula, you're not allowed to say that it's Tzeis Kochavim before you actually see three stars that are reasonably, could be considered to be small stars. And again, for Motzei Shabbos, so most people don't start doing Malacha immediately at the time that we say is Motzei Shabbos, even though that's strictly speaking, it's a pretty machmir definition. Okay. But for those of us who are in shul, for example, you have yourself a 10-minute, 15-minute buffer zone. Again, I don't advocate relying on Zmanim to the last possible minute, and certainly not calculating Tzeis Kochavim based on the actual observance of some type of stars or the appearance of several stars in the horizon and calculating it based on a certain time after sunset. I believe that is completely incorrect, and certainly when it results in a kula should not be done at all.
But if you can't see them, because of the light.
So you have to rely on a calculation on based on how many degrees below the horizon the sun is and how dark it is, and in a place you have to check in different places without light pollution when these stars appear, and you can make that same basic calculation in any place and time based on how far the sun is below the horizon, which results in a certain level of darkness. But again, these very very lenient zmanim for Tzeis Kochavim based on calculating of time after Shkia, I am very very opposed to.
Is that the reason why some groups don't assume the Shabbos is open until about half an hour or more past the time that you normally
do? That's based on the so-called opinion of Rabbeinu Tam that Tzeis Kochavim is 72 minutes after sunset. But I say we don't know what sunset is, and we don't know what Tzeis Kochavim is. So you have to go based on you don't go based on a calculation of time. You go based on the actual observation of stars, which is a davar pashut in my opinion, and that's the way the practice of the Jewish people always was. And these things about calculating a certain number of minutes after sunset are relatively recent chumras. So go to your children in Brooklyn and say that I told them. I'm sure they'll listen.
Right.